supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. So, what did you dream about last night? Me? I've got vague recollections of something involving Karl Rove and Tchaikovsky, but I'm not quite clear about that. Honestly, I have no recollection of last night's dreams. They can be pleasant, silly, terrifying. They can bring back people we knew ages ago or help us skip through space and time. But what do dreams really mean, if anything? My guest today suggests that dreams are meaningful and hold truths about who we are and what we need to know. Roger Kamenetz is the best-selling author of The Jew and the Lotus. His new book is called The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul. He's a professor of English and Religious Studies at Louisiana State University. Roger, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by William Sharp. He's a psychotherapist in Massachusetts. He's also a doctoral candidate in psychoanalysis at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. William, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Roger, Time magazine referred to you as a Jewish dreamer. So is there a difference between a Jewish dreamer and a Christian, Muslim, or atheist dreamer?
No, I think we're all much more alike when we dream than perhaps we think we are when we're awake, and I think that was Time magazine's issue, not mine.
Okay. You've also said that the purpose of dreams is that they come to remind us not only of what we have forgotten, but what we have forgotten we have forgotten. Now that you've got to explain that.
You know, so often people have dreams of being lost, wandering around cities, or lost in train stations and can't board the train, or they've lost their wallet, they've lost their purse, they've lost their car in the parking lot. And I think all of these dreams are actually pointing to something we've lost, which I believe is a connection to the realm of experience of the awesome, of the divine, that not only do we not think anymore it exists, in many cases we don't even think we don't even know that we've lost it, so we've forgotten that we've forgotten.
That's a sweeping generalization
in a
culture that, see, you know, you talk about a connection with the divine,
right?
But you know, you're making that statement in a culture that is becoming more and more religious, so it seems to me.
Well, it's interesting because I think religion is prominent in our culture, and at the same time, I think on the cutting edge, we're seeing a rise of a sort of militant atheism in works, people like Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens. But what I'm talking about is the personal quest, the individual connection, and I think that's often lost. Even for people who might have religious experience, you know, experiences in religion, but not so much as a personal experience, and that's really what I'm pointing to.
So that the function of the dream is really to illustrate our lostness.
That's one function.
The kind you describe.
Well, we're talking really the far end of a journey that begins in another place.
Right.
But I think yes, the dream, you know. The dream can show us and give us experiences that are described in religious books, but they can give it to us directly in a very sensual and direct way. So could I give an example?
Sure.
So I have a client who dreamed that she saw the sun before it rose. She saw it below the earth in these sort of beautiful colors that were just absolutely, for her, mind-boggling, and she felt that this was a spiritual experience, and I think it was. So the dream was giving her a vision of a hidden light, a light that usually we can't see, and I think that it was doing it in a very palpable, direct, and profound way.
I want to turn to you, William, and what Freud's take would be on this. He really had no time for religion and not much time for spirituality. And his take on dream interpretation from my perspective was that it was pretty mechanical, that it was pieces of the unconscious that we needed to find out.
That would be my interpretation on it also, that it is something about and from within the individual psyche and their own dynamics that gets expressed.
So in an interview, and I want to come back to this Time magazine interview that Roger did, I'm gonna quote you, Roger, if I may. You said a dream he ignored is like a letter unopened, which is pretty poignant. But Freud would have said the same thing, wouldn't he, in different language? That a dream comes from the unconscious, and if we're going to grow and be unstuck, we have to understand it. It is like a letter unopened.
It is the whole root of psychoanalysis.
Right, and it's a rabbinic statement, and I think Freud was extremely rabbinic in his, or I would say mainstream rabbinic in his approach to dreams, in the sense that he viewed dreams primarily, I'm simplifying here, as a puzzle to be solved. And he thought that the reality dreams pointed to was a reality in the past. He says dreams are about the past in every sense. So this view of dreaming is rooted in the book of Genesis and the story of Joseph the interpreter. But there's an alternative view of dreaming that's also in Genesis, which I would root in the story of Joseph's father, Jacob.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's when we first hear. I mean, that's a primary dream in the Bible. And Jacob does his brother dirty here, pulls a fast one on his older brother, and gets his dying father's blessings. So all of a sudden he dreams that he's in a hole and a ladder appears.
Well, he's running from this family disaster, you might say. He's cheated his father at the bidding of his mother. I mean, he's deceived his father, cheated his brother, and he's on the run. And he falls asleep on a rock and puts his head on a rock, and in this sort of desperate moment dreams of a ladder between our world and another world. And in that dream, he receives the assurance. God appears to him and says, makes a promise, really, I will be with you wherever you go, which I think is something that all of us at some time or another have wanted to hear. So it's an extremely important dream. And I want to make one point here, is that since we're talking about Freud, not right from the bang, when Jacob awakes, he does not interpret his dream. Rather, the dream interprets his life. He wakes and sees that the place he's in is awesome. In other words, he sees a transformation of the world that he's living in that's rooted in his dream experience.
Well, so, explain that.
Well, unlike Freud, who definitely thinks, inside the box of the material reality, and of course Freud says he's a firm atheist, I think this biblical dream is pointing to the fact that there is a dimension to reality that's beyond what we can count and measure, and that this dimension not only is important and significant, but in a certain way informs our waking reality. So the terms are reversed. My interpretation, if I want to give one, is that the latter is showing that both are real, that it's real all the way through, up and down, and that we divide the world into dream and reality. We, in a sense, half our experience. We lose half our experience.
William, what's your take on what he just said about the dream?
Well, the interesting thing I always find about dreams is that they actually are always some secondary elaboration. It's not the primary process that is occurring at night, because when you wake up, all the defenses and ways kind of that you deal with things in a waking state come back in. So even in telling a dream, retelling it to yourself or recording it in a journal or saying it to your analyst, I think it has a different meaning based on who you're giving that particular dream to, and it conveys an emotional communication.
It's interesting. You know, when I talk about my dreams, there have been two or three dreams over the course of my life that have changed my life, And I haven't interpreted any of them. I've taken them all relatively literally or metaphorically.
Right. And there's plenty of evidence that Freud was completely wrong about the notion, essentially, that he says, again, I'm summarizing, but I hope you'll forgive me, that the surface or manifest dream is bizarre or somehow in a puzzle or inexplicable. In fact, manifest dreams are quite meaningful, and this was the intuition in the ancient world, and it's really confirmed even in our contemporary research. So, to my mind, what we're looking for in a dream is the feeling in the dream, not the meaning as such. It's not a puzzle, but rather we're looking for a feeling. Sometimes we can't see the feeling or feel the feeling, but the feeling's there, and that's where we go to move with the dream.
We are looking for a feeling.
Yes.
How do you know that?
I've been doing this work for about 7 years, and I've worked on both ends. I'm working with people, and I work myself, and I just see it again and again that there's a belly button to the dream, a moment of either feeling or the opportunity for feeling, and that's the key to what the dream is showing us. And I think dreams display feelings. They display a struggle within us, you know, what William's calling dynamics. But that struggle is extremely profound, and I wouldn't limit it to purely emotional issues. It goes beyond that, or goes below that and deeper than that.
I do feel that they have a meaning, and I'm thinking, I'm not as familiar with Jacob and the ladder dream, but if we skip a little bit in the Bible to Joseph's dream, where he sees the ears of corn, and I have to default to your religious education is probably far better than mine, but...
I think you're talking about Pharaoh's dream that Joseph interprets.
The one that Joseph had about he and his brothers.
He sees a sheaf of wheat that rises, and their sheaves bow down to it. That's right.
Exactly. And my thought to that is if Joseph were on my couch, mm-hmm. I would probably caution him against telling his brothers that dream, because that's going to convey a message of, here I am going to be better than you, and it's something that could possibly get yourself killed. And although it doesn't turn out getting him killed, it certainly conveyed a message to the brothers that they picked up on. So there is a meaning, and I think there's also a message.
Well, this is a wonderful instance for my mind. It's interesting that if you think about it, the first interpreters of the dream in Genesis are the brothers. And as you say, their interpretation is quite invidious and hostile. And they are somewhat Freudian in the sense that they view the dream as an ego assertion that somehow Joseph is saying, I'm better than you. However, that's not what the dream means. The dream doesn't refer to a quality of Joseph's ego at all, because Joseph still remains the younger brother who's abused and sold into slavery, and he has other misadventures, as you know. So, to my mind, my reading of the dream is that it's he's being shown his soul. He's being shown his essence, if you want to use that language, and that essence has not yet come into the world. That essence is that he's an upright person, that he's a stand-up guy, you might say, and that this quality begins to manifest as he goes into Egypt and eventually leads him to being the number two guy in Egypt who's in charge of the granary. And 22 years after that dream, Joseph's brothers are in fact bowing down to him, and Joseph remembers his dream and says, you know, he sees it has come to pass. So the rabbis say, quite interestingly, that when you have a dream, you should wait at least 22 years for it to manifest. And I would take that to mean that we need to be patient with the images in our dreams and feel into them and not be so quick to jump to an interpretation, which, as you point out, is quite invidious in this case. And it's not the meaning of the dream in the context of the story, and it's not the meaning of the dream to me. It's a dream that shows Joseph not who he is in the world. It doesn't refer to the past, but it refers to who he's meant to be and who he will be because of the essence of who he is.
Let me ask you a question, Roger, before we go to break. Mm-hmm. William, Freud was clear about where dreams come from. They come from the unconscious. Let me ask the same question of you, Roger. Where do dreams come from?
Well, it's interesting you say Freud was clear that they come from the unconscious, because, you know, what's the unconscious if not the unknown? I mean, it's not even a place in the brain. It's not, what is the unconscious? It's just a term that masks, to my mind, the reality of who we are, which is deeper than that. So, to my mind, dreams are made of materials from memory, and Freud is so brilliant in tracing this down. I have great admiration for Freud, and, you know, point out that Freud had no Freud, so he had to interpret his own dreams. But in terms of where dreams come from, I mean, the materials are from our memory, but that's like mistaking a cake for its ingredients to say that the dream can be reduced back to the memory materials that it's made from. But the meanings of the dream, I think they come from the deepest place there is.
We'll leave it at that, because I know you're not going to go beyond that. That's the answer, the deepest place there is. We're going to take a 60-second break and come back. Let me give the phone numbers out, 888-477-9499. We are talking about dreams, what they are, what they mean, how to interpret them or not. Are they here to give us guidance, insight? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. My guests are William Sharp, who's a psychotherapist in Massachusetts and a psychoanalyst, also with Roger Kamenetz. He's the best-selling author of The Jew in the Lotus. His new book is called The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on 91 FM, WHYY.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, a first-person account of how the Taliban is using fear and persuasion to expand its power in Afghanistan. We talk with Sarah Chase. She reported on the fall of the Taliban in 2001 for NPR. After that, she decided to stay and help rebuild the country. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Our dreams, what do they tell us about who we are, who we are meant to be? Roger Kamenetz is my guest. He's a best-selling author of The Jew and the Lotus. His new book is called The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul. He's also a professor of English and religious studies at Louisiana State University. I'm also joined by William Sharp. He's a psychotherapist in Massachusetts and a doctoral candidate in psychoanalysis at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. So let me tell you one of those aforementioned three dreams I had in my life that were life-altering. One comes at a, actually they all come at times of great despair. In this particular dream, someone comes to me and produces a mink brown butterfly that's 3 centimeters in width. Actually, it was 3 people. And they say, Dan, this is your soul. And for you to be fully human, you have to inhale it whole. It's a living butterfly. I put it in my mouth, and it flaps around. I take it out. I say, this is disgusting. I can't do that. And with 3 men say, well, you're going to have to if you're going to be fully human. And I put it in, and I try it again. I take it out. I say, I'll die. I mean, I'll choke to death on this thing. I'll die. And they said, and that doesn't matter either. For you to be completely whole, you have to inhale it because it's your soul. And I took it in my mouth, and I inhaled it best I could, and when it got in my throat, I woke up. And boy, did I wake up. So let me turn to you first, Roger. I didn't interpret this dream that I know of. My only reaction to that was that the path to wholeness can often be a matter of life and death of my ego. That as long as my ego is alive and robust and healthy, I cannot be a fully spiritual human being.
Yes, and I think in every spiritual tradition we have this notion. Some people call it dying to self. The Hasidic masters called it the annihilation of the somethingness. And this is a part of the process. I was speaking to a client who dreamed that she was told she had to have all of her bones crushed. And she was willing to do it, like you. She did. In her case, she didn't have a huge resistance to that, but she went through this excruciating pain and then joined a group of others who'd gone through that. So the next step was dying, and she was told that Woody Allen would be the next to go. So she was surprised about that. But your dream is so beautiful, and again, it makes the point, I think, if not to make arguments here, but clearly the manifest dream is quite meaningful and powerful, and obviously, like Jacob, you woke, and in a certain way, your reality was transformed, and I'm sure that that dream must have given you some kind of strength or comfort, and you said it occurred at some time of difficulty, and
yeah. It was a gift in that it offered me not comfort, but a path, clarity.
Right.
I guess clarity is comfort. But let me turn to you, William. I have also told people that dreams like this, my most profound dreams, are not subtle. I have to be hit over the head with the reality of what they mean because I'm just not good at dream interpretation. It's not my strong suit. Or would you suggest that I'm not going far enough with this dream, that to take the manifest content and own it is kind of a disservice to myself?
You know, there are so many levels, in my opinion, and I think Freud also said, you know, you can go deeper and deeper, similar to an onion. You know, there's a layer on a layer. And when it's presented in the moment, thinking clinically, if it's presented by a patient on the couch in the moment, you can take it in the context of what it's presented as. If it's presented a year later, it may be on a different level. Mm. It may be being expressed to the analyst for some other purpose. And it's a fascinating dream, but what I actually don't think I would be all that different in some of the ideas that Dr. Kamenetz has brought up, that, you know, there's certainly something about taking in and orality is, I mean, that's, as we start to born into the world, it is how everything kind of comes into us and is through the mouth. So there's something very primal and very life-sustaining in that idea about the orifice of the mouth. And then, you know, butterflies you could associate, again, if a patient were to tell this dream, you know, what does a butterfly mean? It has many meanings in the world, but specifically to you and silently, the analyst might be thinking, well, you know, what part of the dreamer is the butterfly?
Yeah.
What part, you know, there's all different parts of, the dream is made up of all different parts of you.
Well, and the other thing that I took away from this dream that you both might agree with is that the message in the dream to me was what the idea of a leap of faith really means. That what faith really means is being able to take a risk and being able to trust something that is not really knowable. And that's what faith is ultimately. Let's go to the phones. I've been pretty selfish here with tying up your wisdom base. Let's go to Walt. Walt, hi, you're on Voices.
Thank you. My wife and I both dream quite frequently. However, she can usually, as soon as we wake up, she can say, my dream is about this and so. Within 2 seconds of my awakening, if she asks me what did I dream about, I have the faintest idea. They're always gone within a split second. I've had fairly typical kinds of dreams, where I've had people come into my dreams I hadn't thought about in years. I've had dreams about her family, about my family, about no family at all. But they're always going with a split second.
Well, you just confused me. I don't know about my guest experts, but you said your dreams are going in a split second, and then you told us a whole batch of dreams you've had.
No, but I mean, I can think back and say that over the years I've had dreams which involve my parents,
right,
my brothers, and then complete strangers, but they're just there, but I can't remember what the details of them were.
All right, let's turn first to William.
You know, I think one of the purposes of dreams, in my mind, is actually to help you stay asleep, so that people who don't remember dreams might be that there's, you know, between the drives, between life and death and love and hate, there may be enough of a kind of working through in the day and through the dream that you don't remember them when you wake up. And if you do remember them, maybe there's something that's coming more to the forefront that needs a little bit more attention. And the work of the dream to help keep you asleep kind of falls apart and you wake up. And I think very often we regrettably probably remember more nightmares than we do.
Yeah,
more positive ones.
Well, that's part of that must be the nature of the human brain, because we tend to focus on problems and,
exactly,
and negative emotions.
May I interject?
Please.
That theory has been debunked, and it's Freud's theory, and it's just, you know, it's just not true. And the real issue is the brain. I mean, I'm the mystic, but I'll talk about the brain. And I went to listen to some brain scientists, and they point out that the brain, the dreaming brain, is so different from the waking brain. It's like being on very powerful drugs every night. When you wake, there's a shift. So that shift, we can lose the dream very quickly, and I think that's what happened to Walt. It happened to me. It happens all the time. But the real issue is, do we value our dreams? Do we treasure our dreams or cherish them enough to want to remember them? I think, for me, and I think it's great that Walt and his wife tell each other their dreams, because if you have someone who loves you to tell your dreams to, and who values, you know, hearing them, that's a great impetus to remembering your dreams.
The other thing is,
obviously doing this kind of work that I'm talking about, where dreams really create a path that's both a profound psychological path and then ultimately a spiritual path, this becomes, you know, makes the dreams so valuable and so important that we remember them more and more.
Well, but in certainly in Walt's case, he values his dreams. He tries to remember them, and he can. You're not suggesting that the reason he can is because he doesn't value them, or are you?
I don't know how they're valued in the household, but I think the point is that I'm just saying it's like anything else. You have to practice, and if we, you know, I'd suggest having a notepad by the bed, writing them down immediately. This can help, and also, as I said, being part of a process where your dreams are creating this incredible narrative, where you're beginning to have a life in your dreams, and you're learning from your dreams, so that in that sense, there's more of an impetus. So I don't know. I don't want to say, well,
sure,
a lack of
sure,
application
of course,
there. But
you've said, Roger, that, yes, the dreams connect us to the world of the soul.
Yes.
The research shows pretty consistently that younger people dream more than older people. Does that mean as we age, the soul has less to say?
No, I wouldn't make any simple equation there. But, you know, there is a drop-off in dreaming as we age. But most of us are dreaming, if we follow the REM sleep cycle theory, three or four times a night over an entire lifetime. I like to imagine the gross domestic product of dreams. It must be huge, all these dreams that are coming out all over the world every night. But no, it doesn't mean that at all. And I think that as we age, maybe the dreams, there's no simple equation there.
All right,
it's not the quantity anyway. It's the quality of the dream and the depth of the feeling that dreams can lead us to that I think is significant.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Zaya, and I hope I pronounced the name correctly. Zaya?
Hi.
Hi, how'd I do with your name?
Close, it's Zaya.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I came in a little bit late in the show, but I do have a question about dreaming. I want to know if your guests feel there's some kind of a significance to a reoccurring dream. I have a reoccurring dream. It probably happens about once a month-ish, sometimes more, sometimes less. The basic plot is that I'm looking for my home in the form of looking at a house and going into a house and sort of looking it over and trying to decide, you know, do I like it or not. Sometimes the homes or the houses are places I have actually lived, and they're somewhat the same or somewhat different. But I always, almost always, feel, nah, this isn't really quite where I belong. I have been practicing yoga for 25 years, and one of the things that we say in yoga is that the body is the temple for soul, and the body is your first home. And I wonder, that's sort of a secondary question, like, is that part of maybe the meaning of this? And then I'm wondering also about reoccurring dreams.
Well,
I want to ask both my guests to react to that. Let's start with you, Roger.
Well, I don't, you know, we've gotten on this track where we're interpreting and meaning, you know, et cetera, and I just want to say that's not where I'm coming from. And so I'm not going to interpret your dream, and I think it would be wrong to because I don't know you. And I'm not working with you. But I would say that what I would look to is the feeling you have in your dream. And I want to get away from this notion that a dream has a, quote, meaning, and that we're going to interpret it and have the answer. In my view, when we do that, we actually lose the feeling very often. We sort of feel satisfied, and we've lost the feeling. So there's a whole argument in the book I make against that process of interpretation as we usually do it.
So as I listen to you right now, and I'm thinking about that dream about home,
yes,
the emotion could be terror, it could be sadness, or it could be curiosity.
Right, and I don't know, and I wouldn't want to probe that over the air with someone,
sure,
I don't know, but let me just say that the feelings in the dream can lead us somewhere once we feel the feelings and once we recognize the feelings, whereas if we go to say, what does the home symbolize, et cetera, et cetera, I'm not saying it doesn't have a meaning. I'm sure it has, for Zaya, it has a very real meaning. I'm just saying that go to the feelings first and stay with, abide with the feelings, and see where those feelings are in your life. Because the truth is that dreams that repeat can change and shift if we go through the feelings that we're being led to. And there are many examples I give in the book of how someone starts off with dreams that seem sort of unpromising and repetitious and even boring, but they lead to this incredible opening. So there is a way to change your dreams.
Well, William, as you know, I listened to Roger talk about the belly button, the emotion, the feelings. Sounds like a Gestalt therapist to me.
Mm.
So what,
that whole part, and I guess I'm not 100% sure, and I might be, you know, stuck in my own kind of dichotomy of there's a latent and a manifest, and I'm interested in both, but I'm actually also interested in them from an emotional realm, and you know, I've heard it said, and I've read it, and really abide by the fact that if the brain is there and it's running things, and maybe it's a king or a queen, but the heart and the feelings really are the emperor. And although we can again think and intellectualize a lot about a dream or really anything that we're doing, what's the underlying kind of fusion of the drives? What's the underlying balance of our life that we can sometimes infer from what's being presented to us?
Yeah, I mean, Freud, in the book I talk about Freud's dream of Irma, which is at the core of the interpretation, mm-hmm, of dreams. And the point I make there is that Freud, here's a man who dreams of a woman who comes up to him and says, I'm choking, I'm in pain. And his response is to try to force her throat open. And he thinks that's dandy. So I have a real problem with Freud's approach in being intellectual, because I think he missed the feeling in the dream, which was a woman coming to him in pain, and his inability to acknowledge or respond to that in a feeling way is really a problem, not only for Freud, but in a sense for the edifice that he built from that dream. So, and again, I didn't come on the air here to do an anti-Freud session, because I deeply respect Freud as someone who had the courage to venture into his dreams, but I think he led us astray or led us away from the core issue in dreams, which is this moment of feeling.
Well, and who knows where he would be today. You know,
sure.
Who knows the changes over the years. I do have this one comment to make, and then we're going to have to take a break. You know, you both talked about feelings and the emperor and the dream, and my experience as a clinician, as a radio host, has been that most of us get into trouble repeatedly because of unfelt feelings.
Mm.
That feelings we don't fully experience and we just react to. And so many people I know today, that's what's guiding their lives, are unfelt feelings. And I hear you both suggesting that they're trying to call to us somehow in our dreams.
Absolutely. There's a numbness. And in the book I talk about a client who dreamed that a large needle was being inserted into his knee. And he said, I didn't feel a thing. I said, that's a problem. If you can't feel your own pain, you can't feel other people's pain either. So the belly button for some people is the opportunity for a feeling that doesn't happen, or as you would say, it's an unfelt feeling.
Yeah. We've got to take that short break, and we've got to say goodbye to you, William. William Sharp, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
William Sharp's a psychotherapist in Massachusetts and a psychoanalytic candidate. We're also joined by Roger Kamenetz, and he's the best-selling author of The Jew and the Lotus. His new book is called The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul. When we come back, I want to talk with Roger about his dream work, what he does with dreams and where he takes them where we can. We're also going to chat with Dr. Andrew Newberg. He's an associate professor in the Department of Radiology and Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's the co-founder for the Center for Spirituality and Neurosciences at Penn. We're going to talk about the mechanics of the dream, or the biomechanics of the dream, if you will. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Celebrate the Jewish Festival of Lights with Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind. Join us for a delightful and moving hour of songs sung by the Western Wind and holiday stories told by the inimitable Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame. It's Leonard Nimoy and the Western Wind in Hanukkah and Story and Song from PRI.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Our top story. There are no top stories because every story is tops to us.
If people are talking about it, it's news to him.
Amazing. Shocking. Who knew?
Brian Unger brings it to you first.
We have this late breaking news. The news is not broken, nor is it late.
It's the Unger Report.
Are you in or what?
Mondays on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about dreams with Roger Kamenetz. He's the author of The History of Last Night's Dream. He's also a professor of English and Religious Studies at Louisiana State University. Roger, before our break, we were talking about feelings and unfelt feelings and how oftentimes dreams call us to the feelings. I want to come back to your history of learning about dreams, being interested in dreams. It started 10 years ago in Jerusalem, but it wound up in Vermont when you studied with a dream therapist named Mark Bregman. Tell us about him. He was a postman by day.
Right. I was very skeptical about Mark, although I was excited that he was a postman because I thought that would be kind of interesting. He's actually an ex-postman at this point. And I went over to see him, and within an hour, I realized this man had found or knew somehow how to go to the core of what dreams are about. And it was definitely a life-changing experience. I think Mark's hands-on approach is much more similar to how people have always worked with dreams. And I also think that it in many ways, is similar to the original dream venture that Jung went into in the years after he broke with Freud, and he sort of explored his own waking visions.
So how do you work with dreams, Roger?
Well, basically, let me explain through giving an example of some dreams I worked with, and this relates a little to Zia's call as well. I had a repeating dream in which I walked into a classroom, and there were students sitting around a table, and I said to myself, I don't know what I'm supposed to teach. So I thought, well, I went into my mind, and I thought, well, I'll throw a few phrases out and see how they respond, and that will tell me what the class is about. And I tried that, and students turned their heads, they ignored me, they walked out of the room, and I was very upset. I kept having this dream in various forms, and Mark Bregman said to me, well, how do you know you're the teacher? And I said, being a good Freudian, you see, I said, well, of course I'm the teacher, because I've been teaching for 26 years, obviously I'm the teacher. And Mark said, well, does anyone in the dream say that you're the teacher? And I had to admit that no one did. So he gave me what we call a homework, which is basically to take a little piece out of the dream and rehearse it and meditate on it. And in this case, I had to see myself walking into the room with an open mind that maybe I was not the teacher. So I did that for quite a while, and after a time, I had a dream where I walked into a classroom, and I saw the students sitting, and I sat down with them as a fellow student. And then a teacher came in. And it was so moving. It was such a powerful transformation for myself and of that dream. The dream was going nowhere as long as I persisted in thinking I was the teacher. But as soon as I could become a student, not only did the dreams change, but I became a better teacher. I mean, my students say, gee, you're a much better teacher now because I now approach teaching as a fellow student. And I think that this also went to other issues, but you see the point. You go to the feeling and the dream, but you can work with it in waking life and then change your dreams.
And that dream is parallel to a dream you talked about early in the book, about a woman who was chained in her basement, I think,
yes,
talking to Bob Barker.
Right.
And her son came down. She didn't ask him for help.
Right. This is an example of what you call unfelt feelings, which is a wonderful phrase, Dan, by the way. Thank you. And in this sense, the woman was chained in the basement, but she didn't feel anything about it. And she's just chatting away with Bob, and her son kisses her goodbye, and she doesn't say anything. So it was clear in discussing the dream that she had could not locate a feeling. She didn't feel anything. And so I said, well, why didn't you ask your son to help release you? And that's when she realized, oh, you know, it didn't even occur to me because I accepted it, and that's how, that's really how I am. I accept that, and I just put up with it. And this really led to a change in her self-understanding about her feelings.
You know what breaks my heart? This isn't related to dreams, but when I talk to kids about stress, and kids, of course, are under tremendous stress or living with tremendous stress, many of the kids say they're living with stress, but it's normal.
Right.
It's just the way it is.
I mean, I call this our predicament, and I think we all have it, and our dreams display our predicament in a very vivid way as an effort to help us. But if we can't feel our predicament, the dream, I mean, in this case, they were going out of their way in the dream to make her feel it, but she still didn't feel it.
But most people have anxiety about feeling what they feel, and the anxiety usually trumps, the majority of time, the anxiety about feeling our feelings usually wins.
I agree with you, and I think that this anxiety or fear is so primal, it's at the root of the whole history of interpretation. In other words, the issue is not interpretation, but the fearfulness that underlies it, which secretly, I think, is dominating our interpretation and working to dispose of dreams and their feelings rather than to deepen them.
Interesting. Well, we've got somebody who, I don't know, may have a completely different take on this, may not, Dr. Andrew Newberg. Andrew,
yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your program.
Dr. Newberg is an associate professor, Department of Radiology and Psychiatry. He's an adjunct professor in the Department of Religious Studies at Penn, and he's director and co-founder of the Center for Spirituality and Neurosciences at Penn. So, What are dreams, scientifically? What's going on in our brains when we dream?
Well, I guess the bottom line is we probably don't know as much as we'd like to. You know, it's always a very hard thing for us to study. I look at things from a physiological perspective, and of course, the moment that you find out what a person is dreaming, you have to wake them up, so you no longer have them in that state, and that does make it difficult. But one of the things that we do know is that the state of the brain, which is typically going on at the time of dreaming, which is REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep, tends to be associated with some very specific changes in the brain. And in particular, parts of the emotional system, the limbic system of the brain are on. Parts of the brain that help us with processing information are on. The main area that tends to be shut down is the frontal lobes, which tend to be involved in helping us to create our usual sense of consciousness and control over the world.
The our editor, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And so that seems to be taken offline to some extent, but the rest of the brain is very active. In fact, REM sleep is actually almost looks very similar to just our normal waking state. And what most research, I think, tends to show is that there is a lot of processing that goes on, that our brains, when we are asleep, and particularly when we dream, are kind of looking at the information and the data that we have come across in that day in particular, and obviously, you know, any data that we've had all along. But when people are given some kind of task to learn and then they go to sleep, there is a consolidation of that. There's a consolidation of the memories. There's a reliving of whatever the person had done. And so there really is a lot of stuff going on, and I think trying to understand dreams and interpret dreams and try to make sense of them certainly is a very valuable thing and can be very useful, but I think we just have to be real careful about exactly what we can say, at least from a very strict physiological perspective, what's going on, because at the moment we just don't have those answers yet.
Will that day come, do you think, when we'll be able to look under some kind of scope and see what's going on in there, see what the dream is?
I don't know. I mean, anything's possible, but one of the issues that I confront all the time in my research is the subjective nature of an experience. And you can ask a similar question when people are engaged in a spiritual practice where they're having some kind of experience, and you can't just tap them on the shoulder and ask them where they are, because that changes the experience, that changes the state. So we'll have to do the best we can. If we could find a way of having people inform us of their dreams, maybe people who talk in their sleep might be an interesting option for us to look at, because then at least you know what they're saying.
I want to quote something Roger said, and we talked about it earlier in the show. I don't know if you were listening or not, but Roger said dreams are one of the reasons of dreams are to connect us to the world of our soul. Now, you're the kind of doctor that wears a white jacket and a stethoscope. On the other hand, you know, you founded some place called the Center for Spirituality and Neurosciences. So,
right.
So react to that statement.
Well, I think that certainly the brain is reconnecting with itself. It's enabling us to experience things that we've experienced before. It helps us to consolidate and alter the things that we do and believe and think about. It activates our emotional systems. So I think in that regard, you know, I certainly can find some resonance with that statement. I think that it does kind of, they do connect us to who we are. But again, I think we always have to be very cautious about how we interpret things, because there may be multiple possible interpretations, in which case, if we rely too heavily on one, we may begin to take something from them that is not accurate, and we just have to be careful about that. But that's true of almost any area where you're dealing with the human psyche and the human spirit, because there's still so much that we don't really know, and so much of what we think and feel is based on our beliefs and the ideas that we have going in to whatever information that we have.
All right, let me
be careful with that.
Let me interrupt you, Roger.
Yes.
How you doing over there?
I'm very happy with what I'm hearing. My question is never, you know, this is where we're confused in our time. There's a difference between saying what are dreams in terms of the brain physiology, and my question, which is somewhat different, which is what are dreams for? An anatomy of the throat can tell us a lot of the potentiality of a throat for singing, but it could never predict singing or what music means to us.
And I think in the same way, this potentiality we have for this, you know, dreaming, which is facilitated, you know, as Andy is saying, by this huge shift in the way the brain is operating during sleep. I said earlier, one of the physicians at a conference, a guy was from Harvard Medical School, said it was like the brain is really on a set of drugs. You know, we lose contact with our body sense. We lose contact with the precuneus, the sort of the notebook pad, you know, the notepad of the mind, the to-do list part of us. And so what do we do with this capacity? What have we done? What has humanity done with it, and what has it done to us? I think it's been involved with human evolution from the get-go, and it's been changing us all these years. So I have no quarrel with science's approach, and I hope we do learn more, but my question is just slightly different. Can we use dreams to find an experience that seems closed to us very often, the experience of the Austin, the experience of the soul?
Well, Andrew, I'm going to let you have the last word, and I want that word to be a reaction to what Roger just said. Can we use dreams to find the experience of the soul?
Well, I think we can, and I think that, yeah, I mean, he's echoing something that I say a lot about our research, looking at spirituality, is that simply because we have a brain scan of somebody in prayer doesn't mean that we've explained what religion is or explained it away. And I think our ability to deepen our understanding of ourselves biologically, psychologically, socially, spiritually is we need to look at all of those windows and all of those domains of who we are. And I think if dreams are a way of helping us to connect to some part of that, then by all means, I think we need to explore that as thoroughly as we can.
Well, I have to say, both of you are doing fascinating work, and the books you've written are also fascinating. I highly recommend them. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guests have been Dr. Andy Newberg. He's an associate professor in the Department of Radiology and Psychiatry at Penn. He's also the founder of the Department of Spirituality and Neurosciences. We also spoke with Roger Kamenetz. He's the author of History of Last Night's Dreams. He's a professor of English and Religious Studies at LSU. He'll be at the Philadelphia Free Library this Thursday the 13th at 7 p.m. The event is free, so check it out at www.library.philly.gov. Well, you can reach me at my webpage, drdangottlieb.com, and you can hear archived editions of the show there. The engineer for today's show has been Bob Purdick. Gita Simons has helped in production of today's show. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day-to-day.